Thank you all for being here today. As mentioned, I'm going to be talking about a large portion of my dissertation project at A&M, which focuses on the impact of nutrition and diet quality on susceptibility to Cry1AC in Helicoverpa zea. So the field of research I work in is nutritional ecology, and one of the reasons why I find nutrition so interesting is that it's so important. Nutrients are needed to fuel virtually all our cellular processes, and because of this, they have strong impacts on growth and development, reproduction, maintenance, but also protection from different types of stress. And today we're going to focus on stress induced by pesticides. So the pesticide I'm going to talk about is Cry1AC. It's an insecticidal protein produced in transgenic BT cotton. And the use of BT crops is quite extensive. It's grown vastly in the last 10 to 15 years. Currently in the U.S., about 80% of corn and 84% of all corn acreage is some sort of BT variety. And although this technology was developed to control tobacco budworm, there were strong negative effects on Helicoverpa zea as well. And this species is highly prolific. It feeds on over 100 reported hosts. But most importantly, it's the most difficult species to actually control using BT crops. And because of this, growers do see a lot of variability in the efficacy of BT crops for this species, both over the season, across years, and also regionally. So when trying to think about sort of what might be contributing to this variation in susceptibility, there's a couple different things to consider. These two models show genetically determined effects and also environmentally mediated effects. And so these are just standard reaction norms that allow you to visualize how some environmental factor, in this case diet quality, might impact a phenotype of a trait, and in this case susceptibility to BT plants. And so in this first model here, we can see that we have two lines which represent different genotypes. So we have a susceptible strain, let's say of zea, that always, you know, has very low susceptibility to these toxins, but we have a more resistant strain that always does well. And of course in this model it shows that the environment really doesn't have an effect on this phenotype. And I should mention that in terms of resistance monitoring, this is sort of the assumed scenario. However, we have this environmentally mediated model, which I hope to convince you is actually more realistic in nature. And this basically shows that we can take one of our genotypes, such as our susceptible strain, and we can actually see a range of susceptibility just based on diet quality. So on a low-quality diet, we have an individual that looks very susceptible. However, if we put this larvae on a high-quality diet, it can actually look resistant. And it's important to note that we would expect that environmental factors such as diet can also impact a strain that does have some sort of genetic aspect to their resistance. So the next thing we have to think about is, well, what are the odds of nutrition really having an impact on susceptibility? And there's been quite a few studies done in other species looking at this. So there were a couple studies done with locusts looking at the effect of nutrition in terms of tannic acid, which is a secondary compound in grasses. And they found that when these locusts had a high-quality diet, they were more willing to consume the diet, they ate more of it, but also it had an impact on mortality caused by this tannic acid. And then also in Spidoptera, they found that nutrition can have strong impacts on immunity in terms of different pathogens. So we can see that nutrition in other species does seem to have significant impacts on stress and detoxification. So the first thing that we were interested in to get to this issue is we had to figure out what is an optimal diet for zea. So we did a couple choice experiments where essentially we gave larvae access to two diets that varied in protein and carbohydrate balance or ratio. And we essentially let them choose to consume those diets, and we measured consumption of each diet, which then allowed us to calculate how much protein and how much carbohydrates they were actually intaking. And this is presumed to, because they're self-selecting, this is presumed to be the most optimal diet. And so we had three different pairings, so three different treatments, which are shown by these dots here. And we can see there was very little variability across treatments in the intake of carbohydrates. There was a little bit more discrepancy in terms of protein, but I'll tell you that all of these intakes are actually statistically similar. So despite having different options, they chose to alter their consumption to reach this specific balance of protein and carbohydrates. And when we average across all of these treatments, we found that they were selecting for a diet that had a protein to carbohydrate ratio of 1.6. So 1:1 is balanced, 1.6 is slightly protein biased. The next thing that we had to do was to figure out what their options are in the field. So we know that when we give them a choice in the lab, they select for a specific ratio, but what are their options in a typical cotton field? So we went out and we sampled different cotton tissues. We looked at soluble protein content and digestible carbohydrate content in different tissues across a couple different genotypes. We did this in the greenhouse. We did this under field conditions. We looked at changes over time, and I don't have too much time to go into the details, but I did want to show this figure because I think it sort of sums up nicely that there's a lot of variability, even within a single plant, in terms of protein and carbohydrate content. So this shows some of the differences. You can see that we have tissues that are very carbohydrate biased, and we also have tissues which are very protein biased. And also, as we move away from the origin, we see that the total concentration of both of these macronutrients also varies. So we have some tissues which are around 20% protein plus carbohydrates. Others are around 35 to 40%. So there really is a lot of variability. So now that we had this data, we knew that nutrition has had impacts on detoxification for other species. We know that Zea has options in the field as, in terms of what to eat, but we also know it should be selecting for a very specific balance within these tissues. But we wanted to know, is it possible that protein and carbohydrate variation in the field could have an impact on their susceptibility to Cry1AC? So we used these data to create artificial diets where we could control the protein and carbohydrates, and we essentially tried to simulate what we see in different cotton tissues. So we had a diet that was very carbohydrate biased, which was emulating sort of what you would find in a bowl if you just ground up an entire bowl. We had a more moderate ratio, which was simulating true leaves and terminal growth. And then we had a diet simulating squares, which was a more protein-biased tissue. And then we also wanted to look at seed because despite the fact that bowls appear to be very carbohydrate-biased, when we actually took a look at the sub-tissues within a bowl, we found that the seed is actually very high in total macronutrients, but also it's a protein-biased tissue. And it's a resource for Zea, so we wanted to include that. And this also gave us the opportunity to look at the balance of these nutrients in their diet, but also the total concentration. So essentially, we reared larvae on these diets in the absence of Cry, so these were our controls. And then we also tested two sublethal concentrations so that we could look at performance. And today, I'm just going to present our developmental time data. And then we also looked at two more lethal concentrations so that we could assess survival. And we had about 20 replicates per treatment. I also want to point out that the leaf tissue diet and also the seed diet have the exact same ratio, so they only differ in concentration. But they're also the diets which have the ratio most close to the intake target. So we expected these two to sort of be the optimal diet. All right, to get to the results, let's look at survival first. So if we just look at our controls, there's no Cry present in these diets. We see that there's really little impact of these diets on survival. Larvae on each diet do just as well. However, when we incorporate one part per million dosage of Cry into their food, we do start to see important dietary effects. So the first thing you'll notice is that our bowl and our square diets, which represent the most carb-biased and the most protein-biased diets, show the lowest survival, while our leaf and seed diets, which have the same ratio and are closest to the intake target, actually do much better. And because both of these diets do equally well, and they do vary in total concentration, we really see this as an effect of dietary ratio. So the balance is important at this concentration of Cry. And something I want to point out, I'm going to talk about this later, but I just kind of wanted to set the stage for it, is that the leaf and the seed diets, which show higher survival, are closest to the intake target. They're closest to what we think these larvae are selecting in the field. However, if in terms of resistance monitoring, if you look at the artificial diets which are used in these resistance bioassays, they actually are quite carbohydrate biased. So they're most similar to our bowl diet. And you can see if you compare survival across these two diets, they actually are quite different. So just keep that in mind. When we triple the concentration of Cry, we see yet a different effect. So whereas the leaf diet did rather well at one part per million, at three parts per million, it does just as poorly, I should say, as the bowl and the square diet. However, the seed diet, which has a higher total nutrient concentration, does do significantly better. So we see this as a clear effect of just having a higher concentration of nutrients. And again, this diet does match, is close to the intake target, while the others are not. And the typical bioassay diet, again, does much differently than the seed diet. All right, so to look at developmental time, I should mention we didn't see any significant effects of diet on our controls or our low sublethal Cry, which was 0.1 parts per million. However, at 0.6 part per million, we do see some differences. So again, you'll see here, in terms of the time it took the larvae to reach pupation, the leaf diet and the seed diet, which are, again, close to the intake target, showed the least amount of time. Secondly, squares show the next highest amount of time, but the C-biased diet, which is the bowl diet, it took the larvae the longest amount of time to reach pupation here. And we see this largely as a ratio effect. However, because the square diet and the leaf diet aren't different, it's likely an interaction between quantity and quality. But because we only have one ratio tested at this higher concentration, we can't really decipher that with these data. All right, so for conclusions, I think that these data show that nutrition does matter. And to go back to sort of this reaction norm model, if we take our data and we put this into a reaction norm, we don't see this sort of step-up hypothetical model that I presented earlier, but we see this bell-shaped curve. So essentially, if you have larvae on a diet with a PC ratio around 1.3, the survival is going to be really well in the presence of Cry1AC. However, when you move them onto diets in either the direction of being carbohydrate biased or protein biased, they don't do as well. And I think there's a couple important implications for this. One of them is just acknowledging that a lot of the variability that we might be seeing in the field in terms of the efficacy of BT with Zaya could be due to this variation in macronutrient content in the plant. And I think that that's good to know and provide some opportunities to maybe develop some new technologies with that. However, I think a more important implication of this really relates to the way that resistance monitoring is done. As I mentioned, this line shows where a typical artificial diet is, at least in terms of the dose response studies that have been done for Zaya. And as you can see, if you look at survival on this diet versus the diet near the intake target, which is likely that the diet that the larvae are getting in the field, it's very different. And unfortunately, the direction of this difference, which may be confounding results, is that you're going to have larvae in the field feeding at the intake target diet. You're going to take them into the lab and put them on this carbohydrate biased diet, and all of a sudden, instead of expressing this resistant phenotype, they're going to look very susceptible. So this is something where resistance is going to be likely underestimated if using bioassays in this way, at least using it with the diets that are currently being used. And of course, if you can't detect resistance in the lab bioassays, you can't really get at the mechanisms behind resistance. So I think this is something that's very important to consider. And the good news is it's pretty easy to change the diets that are being used. It's just a matter of making them more realistic to the nutrition that these larvae are getting in the field. For the future, we'd like to take this and sort of extend it to some different strains. So the Zaya strain we used for this was a Benzon strain. It's a highly inbred, highly lab-adapted strain, and you know probably doesn't accurately represent wild-type larvae that are in the field. So it'd be interesting to do a similar method with just a different genotype to see if this is the relationship we would get. But we would expect diet to have some sort of impact, even with a more genotypically resistant strain. And with that, I'd like to thank all of our lab members who have, at one point or another, helped me with different parts of this project, and also our funding sources. And I'll take any questions.
Yes.
Yes, so actually I did do a greenhouse experiment where I looked at, I had plants that were fertilized, not fertilized, and then water stressed, not water stressed, and did the exact same thing. I took tissues, measured protein, carbohydrates, but I don't have those analyses done yet. But absolutely, because I think that even something as simple as changing a watering regime or fertilization, you know, plants are so dynamic, so you have a lot of opportunities to make simple management changes that might have an impact. But there's also opportunities to deal with the nutrition that an insect can get out of a plant, like a protease inhibitor, which are what plants do anyway, to exploit something like that. Anyone else? Yeah, I mean, we were definitely interested in doing that because I think one of the issues with this are if you think about it from a genetic perspective, we don't know if the genes involved in some of this resistance to any pesticide really has to do with differences in detoxification genes, but it could very well be in metabolic genes too, which are obviously going to be impacted by diet. So we're very interested to do that, and that's sort of, I think, the next logical step for us. If we can get our hands on some of those lines, it would be a lot easier. But
thank you very much, Carrie.